Die Mediathek der Zeppelin-Universität präsentiert
Radhika Subramania vom 21. Oktober 2014.
Good evening. To those who don't know me, my name is Karen Vandenberg and I hold the chair for art theory and curating here at ZU. And I'm the academic spokesman of the arts program, and Ulrike Shepard organizes these kind of lectures together with me from the arts program. Tonight, it's my great pleasure to welcome and introduce Radhika Subramaniam from New York. Radhika Subramaniam is the director and chief curator of the Shylock C. Johnson Design Center and assistant professor of art and design history and theory at Parsons New School of Design in New York. What a long position. Parsons, the new school for design, is one of New York's oldest art schools. It's founded in 1896. So already in the 19th century. She has a PhD in performance studies and has a master's degree in anthropology. I first met Radhika in May 2013 during a research day in New York and immediately understood that she might perfectly fit into the research interest of the arts program and our teaching program in communication and cultural management at ZU. Why is that? Radhika works extremely interdisciplinarily and dialogical, and her research interests are located between art and politics. And she is very much interested in the reconsideration of the public domain. She works on topics like South Asian urban modernity and cultures of catastrophe. In doing so, she is strongly committed to public pedagogy, critical urbanism, and political and social justice. Therefore, it makes perfect sense that Subramaniam was founding and executive editor of the interdisciplinary art journal Connect, Art, Politics, Theory, Practice, published by Arts International. Before Subramaniam became professor at Parsons, she served as a director of cultural programs at the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, where she commissioned several public art projects in downtown Manhattan. She curated and co-curated several public art projects like Art in Odd Places in 2009. And I'm very much looking forward to her presentation, in which she will introduce her approach as a curator by presenting some of her projects. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Karen. Thank you for the generosity of your invitation here. Really happy to be here. And I want to acknowledge some of my students who have been kind enough, who must be tired of hearing my voice for many hours before, but who've been kind enough to come down this evening. So as Karen mentioned, I have a background in anthropology and a long-standing interest in sort of urban spaces, and particularly in what happens to urban spaces after a crisis or a catastrophe. I started my early work actually in the city of Bombay, now Mumbai, looking at what happened after riots took place in that city in 92, 93. And I was interested in the transformations of that city, in the ways in which belonging changed, the ways in which people began to navigate that space. And so that remains for me a very important kind of guiding principle in how I understand cities. I also had the fortune or misfortune, I've had the fortune to live in New York for decades, but had the misfortune to be there in 2001. And so to some degree, what I'm going to walk you through now are a few projects which in some senses start their story in 2005, but one might also start that story in 2001 with the attacks on the Twin Towers. And they may start as a story for me in 92, 93 when the city of Bombay had riots. So I'm just sort of giving you partly what is a personal story and partly what is also a curatorial journey. Most stories when you think about a city start in the afterwards. So my interest is, in a sense, in the aftermath of something that happens. I'm very little interested in perpetrators and victims. I'm very little interested in sociological considerations of why something happened. But I'm very interested in how people make everyday sense of an environment after something very catastrophic has taken place there. How do you make sense of your everyday when it has been fundamentally ruptured? And so that is something that has been a source of great, something that has gnawed at me for a very long time. So I'm going to walk you through really three kind of major projects and then a little bit of how I work now, which is at Parsons, within a gallery space. So I was at Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, which is in downtown Manhattan, an institution that was in the Twin Towers before the Twin Towers came down. So when the Twin Towers came down, so did this organization, and it had to find another home. And so it did find another home in another building, but it was tied very much to the sort of cultural fabric of downtown Manhattan. And so in the few years after September 11th and after this sort of immediate crisis had taken place, it was a sort of interesting moment in time in New York City when the cultural plan for that site, so I don't know how much you know about the site called Ground Zero, but the site was very self-aggrandizingly named Ground Zero as if it was the beginning of time. And in the master plan that was created for the Ground Zero site, there was also a cultural program. And the cultural program consisted of a dance organization, a very important visual arts center in New York called the Drawing Center. It also had a museum and another kind of newfangled entity called the International Freedom Center. In 2005, there was a kind of explosion of very many different perspectives around the cultural plan, and it began to come into crisis. The Ground Zero planning process has been absolutely riven by the many different groups, particularly what are often known as the families groups, that is people whose families died in the World Trade Center attacks, who have taken upon themselves a very important role in guiding whatever happens, whatever the planning might be on the site. And these groups have a very strong voice in anything that takes place. So as a result of this, of the strong kind of vociferous response by a variety of different groups, the cultural plan for Ground Zero was on exceedingly shaky ground in the summer of 2005. The Drawing Center, which was a very, very well-regarded New York institution, withdrew itself from that cultural plan because it was under criticism, because it often showed artists who were exceedingly critical of the United States and had a strongly critical position on U.S. foreign policy. So because they were coming under flak from families groups that particularly believed that there should be a certain kind of patriotic position, Drawing Center said, well, that's it. We're not really going to be part of this plan. The International Freedom Center, which was an unfortunately named but a slightly newfangled institution that was trying to take this word freedom, which was so abused in the years after 2001, and sort of try to say, what is the history of freedom, or how might we consider the future of freedoms by trying to situate freedom within a much bigger kind of U.S. political context. So taking into account U.S.'s own history of slavery, U.S.'s own perpetration of a massive genocide on which the country itself is founded, that is the killing of Native Americans. So the Freedom Center had this somewhat critical project, and Freedom Center also sort of met its demise, or was coming to an end at that point, because the conversation around September 11th was getting increasingly narrow, and it meant a certain kind of badge-wearing, nationalist kind of political project. So this is the moment when I was at LMCC, Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, and it was a moment where it was 5 years after September 11th, so it was a good moment in time. There had been enough distance to think about what we might do as a cultural organization in response to that. It was also because it felt urgent that there was a way in which the cultural project for the site was being hijacked by only a particular point of view. So I started a two-year kind of initiative trying to bring together the role of arts in the context of what was then being called, it's not a word I would have used myself, but you know, was appropriate to use, in the context of recovery. What is the role that art can play in urban settings when there has been a type of crisis and we're trying to look at rebuilding? We're trying to kind of look at the rebuilding of the site. And recovery is a word that was commonly used, so I sort of started to use it. And the fundamental kind of principle, which is one that has been of great interest to me, was this question, and you know, the slides are from the promotional material that we created for this event. So it was, how do people make sense of everyday life after catastrophe? So how do you go on in your world when something very major has happened to you, and how do you deal with the completely ordinary things that have happened, that are happening to you in that context? How do you still make common sense meaning out of it? It's my kind of fundamental belief that we live our lives in the everyday. My students may not be surprised by this insistence of it, that what's really, really important to us doesn't exist in the majestic, in the grand, in the big grand récit of life, but they exist because you feel, you like the smell of something in the morning, the coffee is really warm and good, you love to touch your lover's hand, you smell, you know, you walk out and the sun is warm. These are the things that make life worth living. It's rarely the big, big things. So I'm kind of very interested in the ordinariness of existence, and I'm very interested in the way cities make ordinary life possible, and the ways in which a very diverse groups of people in large cities, particularly like New York, also in Bombay, kind of live out a life together where the everyday is very, very hand in glove, jostling one another all the time. So these were some of the questions that aside from asking how do people make everyday sense of life after catastrophe, also started to ask how do artists contribute to this question? How do artists contribute to the issues of renewal, which was very important, to a sense of hope, as also to an idea of reconciliation, so that it isn't a polarizing, you're not setting yourself up in a polarizing way, you're actually exploring or opening up a conversation that has sort of open-ended directions and isn't already framed. So many times at design meetings regarding Ground Zero, the families groups would say, we are not anti-art. You know, we are not Philistines. We are actually very, very cultured people. But why don't you bring someone like Bruce Springsteen? We wouldn't say no. So the idea was, I love Bruce, so it's not about saying that. The point was more that only insisting that art should heal and that healing takes only a certain kind of monolithic form, that's what I wanted to question. Art, or the role of art, is actually in allowing a kind of plurality, in allowing you to recover, to deal with grief, to deal with emotions in a complex way, not in foreclosing these options. So that was the question, how do artists contribute? And also, because that was very much an issue downtown, how should we remember? Why are we presupposing what the ways are in which remembrance sort of takes place? So I am also interested in a kind of interdisciplinary conversation, so it was very important to me that there was a wide range of artistic disciplines at the table, visual artists, writers, playwrights, theater folk, architects, filmmakers, and so on. They came from all over the world. So in the first iteration in 2005, the idea was looking at cities across the world that had these kinds of crises. So people came from Belfast and Beirut and Phnom Penh and Johannesburg. So it was the idea was to bring into this conversation other people from other places that have also dealt with this, so as to really work against New York's sense of exceptionalism, or really an American sense of exceptionalism. And I thought of it at that time very much as finally returning New York to the rest of the world. Americans detest the city, Americans from the rest of the country. It may be a magnet of various kinds, but it's not a city that people care that much for. And when they come, and it became in the years after 2001 a very strange moment when there was a kind of kitsch tourism where people came to look at the Ground Zero site. And suddenly it seemed like you could embrace New York because it was becoming properly American. And so my sort of effort was saying, New York always belonged to the world. New York always looked elsewhere to the world. So what would it mean to return this conversation to the rest of the world and to learn from people who have had much longer histories of civil war, genocide, and so on, to learn how people have tried to deal with it. So this is just a quick map of Lower Manhattan, just to give you an idea that we began to situate the various projects, which were exhibitions, conversations, kind of public artworks, walking tours, and a wide array of things in several different locations all across downtown. At LMCC, I didn't have a gallery or a theater or anything. Everything we did was in sort of public space. So part of trying to populate the conversation, this is basically the Ground Zero site. So everything we did was sort of located in different, this is just our New York City subway system, but these are all the various locations at which we had a range of different projects. Give you the sense, both so you have an idea of the many countries. This is from the second year in 2006 that people came, as well as an idea of how many things one thinks about when you deal with the aftermath of an event or of a crisis or a catastrophe. Remembrance, reparation, reconciliation, reconciliation comes twice. Anyway, resilience, right? So we were thinking about the city in a variety of different ways. It was also, by 2006, New Orleans had suffered the effects of Hurricane Katrina. So there were a lot of different conversations going on in the U.S. itself, and it seemed a time as well to bring in many other contexts. It's the only time in my life I've received hate mail. It's the only time in my life I've received phone calls that were very hateful phone calls, mainly that said, how dare you invite other people here when this is our tragedy? So I say that because it reminded me that I was doing the right thing, at least by my own lights, right? That I felt I was doing exactly that, because if someone from the middle of the country could call to say, how dare you have this event, then it meant these projects had some sort of valence. And I just give you this because it tells you a little bit about the prehistory of the World Trade Center site. So the World Trade Center site only went up in the 60s. And prior to the World Trade Center going up there, there was a very, very active kind of neighborhood called Radio Row, basically electronic shops and kind of electronic parts and radio store. This is actually a photograph by Bernice Abbott, a very famous kind of urban photographer. And it was eminent domain. Eminent domain, I don't know if you know what that is. Eminent domain is a process whereby you can basically appropriate land in order to build something else, in order to develop it in another direction. So by eminent domain, that is basically getting rid of all these small business owners. The World Trade Center, you know, the Twin Towers, the original Twin Towers went up. Now, much earlier, prior to Radio Row, that neighborhood in downtown Manhattan, until the 30s and the turn of the century, was actually a Syrian neighborhood. It was called Little Syria. And it's hard not to think that there's a certain kind of return of the repressed, right? That there's a certain sort of return to the site of ways of life that did live there and did exist there that begin to transform and return in a totally different way to that location. So as I was thinking of this, and by pointing to these earlier histories, by the time I'd finished these couple of years of working on cities, art, and recovery, I was starting to think about what did it mean to continually be asked to remember something, and that there is an important part of moving on or being able to resolve or find a certain resilience that demands a certain level of forgetting. We can't remember, if you have lost anyone, you know this, right? That part of losing someone and then feeling the intensity of grief and then realizing some months or a year later that there were a few moments where you didn't think of that person, then you feel very guilty and you think of them again, but there are a few moments and then those few moments get bigger and bigger and then you don't really forget them, but it's still okay and you have sort of moved on. And so I began to be interested in the relationship of forgetting to memory. Like, what is the necessity of forgetting? And also beginning to ask how one event eclipses all of these other stories. So that there exists in this site, now called Ground Zero, there exists a whole set of other stories that have been obliterated. Does it mean we have to remember all of them? Does it mean we have to keep thinking that every single thing has to be resurrected and receive a plaque? Probably not. So my question was, is there a kind of everyday amnesia that's an absolutely necessary part of being urban? That there is a certain sort of cycling through of bits of memory, bits of forgetting that each of us holds and snags in a range of ways that is, in a sense, New York or any other such large city. So I started thinking then of a much larger project that might be, that was a kind of an 18-month exploration for me through a commissioning process of the idea of amnesia. Like, what does it mean to think of amnesia as a way of thinking about city space, particularly to think about the notion of spectrality, that is ghosting, that a city is full of ghosts, and you have ghosts of people, you have ghosts of places, you have ghosts of things gone by, that the ghosting is part of what we want to think about when we think of cities, and how do we then kind of explore that in a curatorial way? So I put out a call for proposals, for a sort of a commissioning of proposals, and asked artists to respond to a call. The commission was called Off the Record. You know the expression Off the Record? To be off the record? Yes. And this was basically the kind of call to which people were asked to respond. So it says, ours is an age of record keeping. We are ushered in and out with certificates. Our lives are registered daily with credit card swipes, internet logins, security checks, and surveillance cameras. No longer is memory jogged with the occasional souvenir, aide memoir, or pressed flower. Every moment is registered for the future by photographs, credit and debit cards, blogs, internet cookies, fingerprints, passports, and caller IDs. To be undocumented is effectively to disappear. If our everyday life is now an archive, how can we forget anymore? What does it mean now to be off the record? So this was what artists were asked to respond to. And I'm going to talk about one project that we then sort of produced. So Yehuda Duenas is a theater artist who is the head of a company kind of amusingly called the National Theater of the United States of America. It's a very tongue-in-cheek, very small group of young artists who was then one of our lead commissions. So what Yehuda proposed was he wanted to have a space, a kind of storefront space. And he wanted to take the storefront space and make the street basically the stage. So everybody would sit inside a storefront, they would have the windows of the storefront, and they would look out at the street, and he would score a musical score, and you would sit, you would all be let in, you'd pay 10 cents or some really small amount of money, like 25 cents, and you would come in, and you would just, the street would be choreographed, just because there was music playing, you would feel the street was choreographed. And so we started with that premise, because what he was interested in was that there was everything in the city could be remembered or forgotten, and it was there, and there was a kind of choreography to daily life that could kind of entice you. But we developed into much something much larger. So we took, the LMCC used to have a system of sort of swing spaces, spaces we took temporarily, turned them over to artists for a time, and then when the landlord rented it again, you know, was given over. And so this was an old adult movie store that, you know, had gone out of business, and so, you know, this is like videos and DVDs and so on, and LMCC had it. And so we took the store, the store, and that what you see is sort of basically behind this. and it was covered over, and it was turned inside into a real jewel box theater. So very kind of grandly created interior. So this is basically before the show begins. But it's before the show begins, but really the show is here. And everyone who is going to watch the show is seated inside the theater, getting ready to see the show. So they're behind the curtain. But obviously, this man has not come to see the show. He's actually just standing at the bus stop waiting for a bus. So there were people who were just standing there talking. There were people who had come to see the show. There were some of these members who were both members of the audience, but then they became part of the show for people inside. And they were sometimes watching those inside. So it changed the dynamic of the interior and the exterior. Here are people getting ready for the show. And then the show was choreographed all across the street. So this is the far end of the street. It's near City Hall. And I'm just going to sort of quickly take you through a range of different. There were 100 artists invited to perform, and they were basically creating 1 million moments. So there was synchronized swimming that took place basically across the median strip. If you know this area, it's actually a big road that leads right onto the bridge. So you have to time it very carefully. The synchronized swimming was between the cars. Spider-Man's popped in at some point and grabbed a hoodlum and sort of took them away. There was a Bhutto performance that was also happening in sort of painfully slow movement across the street. There was a student who was just a university student who suddenly found himself in the middle of the stage set. And, you know, so that's just, he's just walking by. The storytelling going on. This is a kind of evocation of the maritime history of downtown New York. This is a very famous Life magazine. So this was a couple who just basically continually kissed at different locations, but they would appear and you would see them kind of enacting. And this man, it was right before the first Obama election, and this man was evidently running for president as well in his own mind. But he chose this kind of built-in audience to suddenly enter and decide that Robert Haynes, he was going to tell us his presidential platform. So people were kind of coming in and out and creating this event. And we held it over an entire week around September 11th of 2006. So what this did was got me interested in basically how one creates activity in a city where the public space regulations are being increasingly constrained. So what's possible for us? So this project was done entirely. We got permission. You know, we had permissions inside. We worked with the New York City Police. They were aware. At one point, we discovered that City Hall is an intelligence office. They came and checked us out and so on. So it was done, you know, making sure that the artists had all kinds of permissions. But then I began to think, what if we were to work in this city that has for many, many years been a real haven to artists and has been a site of a great deal of freedom? What does it mean that we continually have to ask permission? So I got involved in this project called Art in Odd Places, which was initiated by an artist called Ed Woodham as a very much a grassroots program. And for two different years, I worked as the curator for this project. In 2009, with a colleague, Erin Donnelly. And the theme for this this project was basically that it would take place along 14th Street, which is a fairly major thoroughfare that runs from sort of river to river in Manhattan, and is a very complicated has a diversity of different things that happen on the street. And it would take place over a period of time in October. The premise of the Art in Odd Places is basically this, that you explore the odd, ordinary, and the ingenious in everyday life. It presents art in all disciplines outside public space regulations. So the importance for artists was trying to figure out how you work in public space in the aperture between regulations. So they are not illegal, they're sometimes non-legal, though. They have to often, so we have certain simple rules. Always keep moving. If someone stops you, don't disrupt traffic. So it's trying to figure out how you work in and around NYPD, business owners, a whole bunch of different things. But how do you work so that you can still perform, still show, still create work in the public space of New York City? So this was basically the call to artists. The rubric was sign, And we just basically said, respond to this. This is all the possible meanings or a whole set of possible meanings of sign. It could be an indictment, it could be a sense of ownership, it could be an omen, it could be a signature. And artists were asked to respond. So here are just a quick set of projects. Olek was a Polish artist who's basically a crochet artist. And so she created a whole set of these sort of brightly colored camo crochet creatures who appeared all over the place holding signs. And these signs, like left for men and right for women, were signs that she took from other places. And these people just appeared as these strange sort of faceless characters in different sites on 14th Street, kind of holding a sign that said something. Pam Payne took over a building where she owned an apartment, and she asked several different apartment owners on the corner of First Avenue to lend them her windows. And then at night, she recreated scenes from the history of 14th Street. So Warhol had his factory on 14th Street. It's 14th Street's also the sign of very, very big rallies, anti-war rallies. So all of these windows would turn, the building sort of turned into a, you know, you would stand across the street and the building would turn basically into a kind of projection box, a light box of different things that were going on. Michelle Brody created a walking tour of New York City manholes, 14th Street manhole covers. Lulu dressed herself up as a kind of turn of the last century newsboy. And she gave out the 14th Street Tribune, which then, you know, would tell you things that were going on at another point in time. So it would be like, you know, extra, extra, read about what happened here. So this is the catastrophe at the Grand Ball. So it would tell you stories of another moment. And she created four different editions of this newspaper. We actually had people call us and say, I missed the newsboy. Where is the newsboy? You know, is he going to come back and give us the newspaper? Tim Teasel. So these are cones. These are traffic cones, very common in New York. And so Tim took these traffic cones and turned them into fountains. So he's also just playing around with street furniture. Crystal was another crochet artist who crocheted these. These are very common, like empty lots. And she took the barbed wire, the razor wire that's on top of them, and started creating these sort of crocheted things. So you would suddenly find something that has a fairly aggressive edge to it, softened with the edge of crochet. Eric and Mia were a whole set of sleeping artists. I guess there's a kind of interest in a city like New York and finding the moments of time when you actually switch off. And people would create sleeping masks with Eric and Mia, and then they were asked to take the sleeping masks and sleep. So this is in Union Square Park. So people, you would just have large groups of people suddenly just making masks and sleeping in the city. Jamie, on the other hand, slept himself. He created a kind of standing sleeping apparatus, and he would bolt himself to the subway grating, and he would fall asleep. And it was exceedingly peculiar to stand around Jamie when he was sleeping. He would really fall asleep for about 45 minutes, because people would go very closely, and then they would not be sure, because he has these, you know, shades, and he's there, and he's very vulnerable, actually. So it's very difficult to fall asleep in public, in a city like New York, where, you know, people are quite crazy, and allow yourself to just be that way. And people were simply not sure what to do with him. So it was a kind of an interestingly aggressive sleeping. We were in the middle of a mayoral election. Our new mayor was being elected, and our mayor had illegally extended his term limits, so he was serving for another term. So I don't know if you know The Simpsons. So you may know this. So our mayor's name at that time was Michael Bloomberg. So this group of artists, a pair of artists, ran a project under Concerned New Yorkers, and they ran Montgomery Burns, against the mayor. So Monty Burns is, you know, obviously a millionaire of a kind. Our mayor at that time was a very rich man. So they said, let Monty's millions beat Bloomy's billions. And so they ran him, saying, third Burns for mayor. Believe it or not, they got the largest number of other votes. It was about 35, but they got the largest number of write-in votes at that time. We went through a lot making sure that Fox might not come down on them for infringement of copyright, but evidently Fox actually wrote them a nice note at some point, because we were worried that the artists might get into trouble. Lake and Matty created a kind of, so street was being gentrified at that point, and particularly one neighborhood had had a big kind of buyout by a developer, and so they created two sort of counter rallies. They created a fictitious booklet, brochure, for a completely fake tower that was supposedly going up, wasn't really, on 14th and 1st, and then they created a fictitious counter rally in opposition to it. So they were giving out both the brochures, saying there's going to be this new tower, and creating the sending this thing out, saying there's going to be a protest rally, as a way of starting a conversation with people about gentrification in their neighborhood. So people would stand, so they would be sitting on a, you know, standing in front of a table and giving these things out, and people would start saying, oh my God, there's going to be not another tower, don't tell me Time Warner is doing this. You know, there would be a, Time Equities is buying yet another thing, and so there would be a kind of debate that was set in motion. Nick, it was a very much a recessionary period in the US, and so Nick did these kind of poems on the ground, basically stenciled poems on the ground in front of every shop that was shuttered. So these are all sort of shops that have their doors down because there's, they've gone out of business. And so he started doing these things out of ash on the ground. Heidi did there has been a project called the Manhattan Project, which is looking at what Manhattan looked like in the 16th century when Henry Hudson kind of came up. And so she used the Manhattan Project data in order to create a guide for what 14th Street would have looked like 400 years previously. And then finally, Heidi and Nick got together and they actually started stenciling so you would have here, for example, you know, the city actually goes on a bit more, but this is where the shoreline would have ended in 1600. And so you would have, as you walked along 14th Street, you would have these things underfoot that said oak hickory forest, nuts here, 1600 shoreline. So you would see what was happening 400 years before in the city if you paid attention to that. So Siriako Lopes did these love letters. They were basically gay. Sort of west side of 14th Street is very much, is sort of Chelsea and inside of Stonewall, not far from Stonewall Inn, so very, very important for gay and queer history. And so he did these kind of love letters from famous gay people that would be tucked in different places. So it was just a kind of a small intervention, because people who found these very beautifully, gorgeously written notes would just find them, and they were just notes to be sort of taken away. Sal Randolph did, again related to recession, basically she gave away $1 bills. And so there were $1 bills that would be rolled up in these various places, and you could just pick them up. Sometimes they would have her website number and website address, and so sometimes people would write back, so she could track some of these dollar bills, and people would often write back to explain what they did. And many of them felt that money that you found like that as a gift was money you couldn't keep, you had to give away. So she found a very interesting kind of journey of the bills that she started giving away. And this last project was actually by a pair of artists who had moved to New York from New Orleans, and so had a very interesting relationship in a sense to both oil and water. And they did this installation in a gas station, in a petrol station on the far west side, where this is basically sort of the images you get when oil and water mingle. And it was put outside the car wash as a kind of giant projection. And the car wash guys liked it so much that even after the Art and Art Places had gone, they wanted to keep this on for a while. So it actually had greater meaning for them, who see these kind of the beauty in this every day. So they sort of continued the project. So this is a little bit of what I wrote in the catalog, and I just say this because it's in a sense an important part of my thinking about public space, which is every public space needs odd places. These are the places that lie between the lines of maps, thick interactions and common perceptions, peculiar, upside down, out of focus, underneath, outside, discarded. These places are inevitably in full view, yet remain unnoticed. So they get lost, found, and lost again, but not always by the same people.
This is where art in odd places finds a home. Created in response to the tightening cincture of public space regulations, it is committed to finding the spaces between them. Are you going to ask a question?
I would be interested, why would you say every public space needs these places? So what is the reason for that position?
Okay. To be under the full glare, full spotlight of view, to be constantly in the full spotlight of view is actually, to my mind, not an untenable place. We also always need a little shadow. So that's what I mean by a public space cannot be something in which people are talking continually. You need the underside of something in order to have the oversight. So you need spaces in which those who do not receive the ability to have, say, free and fair democratic interaction, which is one of the principles of the political in public space, you need the guys who are going to skateboard at night, right? So in a place which is your city plaza in front of your great federal building is maybe where certain kinds of people are able to find a home. And when everybody goes away, there are the kids who skateboard, there is the homeless guy who's feeding pigeons. So that's what I mean by places that get that allow all kinds of people to exist in it. And so I'm not saying that these are not absent places. These are places that are found by different people. So the homeless guy finds the grate where you have warm air from the subway, for example, in New York City. That's where homeless people sleep because that's where warm air comes and you create it. It's a meaningless space for me because I'm housed, so I have warm air, but it's a very meaningful place to someone else. So all places need this. All spaces, particularly in big cities, but really everywhere, all places need those places that are odd. Everything can't be made even.
And am I right in saying that all these little projects that you were presenting here were created or were done to create these odd places? So
some of them are about finding oddness, yes, finding the odd places, but you assume that after the project has gone, so it was there between 1st and 26th, so between 1st and 26th of October, there were 60 artists performing or creating these projects. After that, they'll disappear. They may continue to have meaning for some people, they may never, some of those shops probably have, somebody buys, takes over the franchise and somebody opens a shop, then that place doesn't have the same meaning. Meaning changes, right? Meaning changes. It is about finding the odd places, but it's also about losing the odd place.
So would you say that all these odd places that were once created have to change after a while?
Yes, because otherwise it won't be odd. If I'm looking at you, if you're constantly in the spotlight, there's nothing, you know, we always have to step out from the spotlight to the shadow, otherwise there's no meaning in that moment, right? Yes, back there.
Am I right when you say that oddness probably also means that there's always a change of meaning? So when you say one place is used in different ways, it's a change of meaning.
Yes, it's a change of meaning. So no place is inherently odd. I mean, there may be some places that are, but no place is odd just because I say, oh, there is an odd place. The fact is, it's a way of looking. Right? And it's a way of crafting meaning to something that might have one function but can be repurposed for something else. And so it's that ability to, in a sense, see the oddness. So art in odd places is not saying, oh, let's do this thing in all of the windows along 14th Street. There's nothing particularly odd about that. I mean, people do use the windows and so on. But it's not sort of saying, let's find really good places to show art. It's about saying, what's an interesting place in which you can, like acupuncture, make a little intervention that opens another kind of conversation, right? And so it is about finding the ability to see oddness. Odd both as peculiar, odd both as not even, not regularized, right? So I'll take you through something very quickly, which is, So last year, I came back to Art in Odd Places, and this time we looked at the idea of number. This was part of the call to artists. There was also another kind of wackier version of it. But the call to artists was here, respond to it, and here is, for example, a series of numbers. You don't need to know, many of them are very American numbers. You'll have other numbers. But it was just a whole series of different associations. But this was don't read this, okay? This is just a quick way of sort of saying, we were really saying, numbers are oppressive, they're everywhere, we're continually crowded by numbers, there's treasure, foreclosure, precision, penury, counting votes, counting cards, light years, leap years, grids, statistics, grades, scores, zip, zilch, zillions, billions, you know, numbers, 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 etc. So it's like, respond to the fact that there is this continual oppression with numbers around you. And this was a little bit of what I said in that catalog, which was also responding to, which was also about art and odd places, saying numbers are shapeshifters. There's something exceedingly precise about numbers. So number is the only thing where you can say 18,412 point. You can be exceedingly precise, but it also can be incredibly large. So there is a mix. There's a mixture of something that is exceedingly disciplined and extremely volatile about numbers. They seem very transparent, but they're very slippery. And in a way, they are a very, very big part. There is some, you have numbers in, whether it's on your cell phone, whether it's your birth date, whether it's your PIN number, numbers are sort of everywhere. So here are a few completely quick, playful projects. So Susan and Sasha created basically a hopscotch on the sidewalk, and you can see people are using the hopscotch in a variety of different ways. So this is, I mean, to answer the gentleman in the blue there, this is, you know, there's not, creating a hopscotch is not anything new. Creating it on the sidewalk is something kids do all the time. Creating on 14th Street is different. When somebody decides they're going to do a little bit of bebop and play around with it and stand on their arms, that's turning that space into something different, right? And so here are a few. Merav basically, this is a New York obsession, real estate. So she basically created the footprint of her apartment, so you can see how big it is, on the sidewalk, and then invited people to come into her apartment. People, of course, walking up and down the street. This guy evidently stood in her bathroom and had a phone call that's on a... but she would be very seriously like creating these floor plans. Sam and Julia basically changed some city signs. So it was all on 14th Street. So they were like number of days in a fortnight street, or 30 divided by 2 minus 1 street. So they basically got up, evidently they put on some orange coveralls, just put a thing up and created. So this is pretty much what New York City signage looks like. So it's phantom enough that, you know, the Department of Transportation isn't going to take it down immediately. But it, you know, it's really just meant to be kind of playful. Rory was a human cannonball who kind of counted down from 0 to 1 and then sort of took off. He unfortunately decided to be a human cannonball in the middle of an intersection, so in the middle of the zebra crossing, and he was taken away by the cops and admitted to a psychiatric ward. Thankfully, he got released, and then because he was sort of a bit terrorized by that experience, because they thought he was crazy, and that, you know, thankfully they thought he was crazy, so he wasn't thrown into jail. He was actually just taken for a psych evaluation. But he was released at the end of the psych evaluation, and then he wanted to find, somehow he wanted to find his oomph again and to be able not to be scared of working on the street. So when he did when he sort of was scheduled to be here again, he found a whole group of cannonballs. So that you know, so they're just getting, so that's like, he invited a group of people to be a cannonball with him, and so they're just crossing an intersection in order to be a cannonball. There were a group of kids from Rhode Island who are also our performers, who did a project that, so the theme was number, and basically was all the zeros. So there are 0 women mayors in New York City, there's 0 presidents in the US. So we're sort of using how many places women are basically non-represented. And they did that, and they would just perform on the street. The Institute for Sociometry created these incredible kind of boxes that would take some sort of a theme around number, and you would insert your face into the box, and you'd have a mirror. So basically, you would see yourself reflected, but you would see yourself reflected with another image. So they would change the images, and that's what he's doing there. So for example, 9/11 had both a firefighter, so someone considered to be, you know, very much what in the US is called a first responder, you know, somebody who's at a scene of crisis, and it also had the kind of face or the outline of someone with a kafir, with an Arab headdress. So you could take 9/11 and you would see your own face either with a headdress or with a firefighter's. And so there were a whole series. I mean, that's just for 9/11. There were a whole series of other things. Ariella basically did a social... New York produces an extraordinary amount of garbage. And so she started finding trash and creating these little kind of labels with them. So they were everything from I Am Lost, Single One, or I Love You More, and she would just have to stage them whenever she found garbage. So they would be, they would create a little sort of theater piece around the, just a brief theatrical moment with the garbage. Lulu, again, who did the other, did the project in 2009, came back and she decided to be a kind of 1950s phone operator. So it was a moment when phones had, when exchanges had names, you know, so you called Mayfair 122, you know, when you didn't just have numbers, you actually had words that were the exchange. But she would ask to, she would offer to connect you to a number that you had long gone. And she has, in fact, if you go onto her website, she has the recordings. People called their dead mother. People called girlfriends they had broken up with. And so people actually took this completely kind of playful opportunity to do the, make a phone call to their past, to a number, which she would connect to in a good old-fashioned way. And they would leave a very real message to a real person who had gone by. And so obviously remembrance of phone numbers past is, if you know your Proust, you know where that comes from, right? Jodi again did a project where she bought lottery tickets, lotto they call them, and gave them away. And you could get a free lotto ticket, a lottery ticket, if you wrote down what you would do with that many millions. So people had extraordinary, she has on her website a collection of really exceedingly moving things. Very few people are going to buy themselves a rich house. Everybody is going to take care of their mother, give it to dogs. People actually have very moving things that they do with the many millions that they might get. So she's been collecting this for a very long time. So she did that. And so I just want to end with a few slides that tell you, because this is a lot about working on the street, and a good deal of my life is actually spent running the galleries at Parsons. So I just want to connect the work that I've done there very, very quickly to the work that I do within a gallery space, which I still take to be something that is very much in the public sphere and the public domain. Yes?
I'm sorry. Did you ever do some research on the impact of these projects?
Some research has been done by Art in Odd Places over the years, but it's a bit ad hoc. So we would need somebody else to come in and sort of look at it. I can say the kind of impact is somewhat anecdotal. It has to do with the amount of press we receive, Art in Odd Places has received, the fact that people in the neighborhood remember it and ask it, in a sense, to come back. But no, no formal research. It might be a good project for someone to take on.
So how can you be sure that anybody understood what the artist did?
I can't be sure. I can know from people who speak to us that they have understood or not understood. To my mind, no, you don't know. I can assure you that when you go into a museum, I have no guarantee. Nobody has any guarantee. Picasso doesn't know any more than anybody else whether you understood what he was doing. I mean, I'm quite sure of that. So I don't think that's the measurement. I don't think the measure is, did you individually understand? Several people who encountered it have an experience, and you can say something about that. But the city is much, much larger than in the longer part of the catalog. Actually talks about the fact that you can have 60 people performing on 14th Street. 60 is a lot of people. 60 plus people performing on 14th Street for a period of time, and many, many people are not even aware anything happens, because New York is way bigger than 60 artists making an intervention. So I don't know that it's a one-to-one impact. It is an impact in terms of the kinds of things it opens up within a fairly small milieu, which is quite frankly no more, no less, it seems to me, than what would happen if you hung a painting on a wall and hoped that something, some very meaningful thing is generated out of it.
Well, and can you imagine any way how to conserve these impressions of projects and the impact on the viewers or the observers of them? Or, I don't know, any scientific infrastructure or to do science in,
to do good old-fashioned samples and surveys. One could do that, and somebody could take that on as a project. It's not my project to do, but someone who wishes to research in that kind of sociological way could indeed take that project and choose to monitor and get surveys and responses and so on.
Yeah,
is that what you mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you, as an anthropologist, you could also have the idea of like doing an ethnography project, and you observe the places where all this happens, all come with a behavior changes.
Right, I don't think you're going to get that. That's what I'm saying, it's a very big city, so you're not going to get, this is very exciting.
Yeah, that's another effect.
Yeah, another effect outside. I take very, where I see myself to be both an anthropologist and a curator is that 14th Street is my backyard. I've known 14th Street for almost 30 years. So I have a very long association with this context. So in it, my ability to frame 14th Street is not like the ability to, of anybody to frame 14th Street. It is actually a place whose ideas, and part of why I'm sort of showing you the history of in a way of thinking, is not that, oh, this is a really nice street, let me do it. I mean, surely one can, but it's actually talking about the sedimenting of a set of responses over time. So to be able to do something in 2009 in 14th Street and to frame the questions and frame the entire Art in Odd Places curatorially, to do it in 2009 and do it in 2013, there were very, very different decisions made. I both have relationships on that street. I don't mean personal relationships, I mean business relationships, relationships with store owners, facilitating a kind of operation, making that happen. All of that to me is a curatorial task and is an anthropological task. It is about, in a way, an ethnographic observation of daily observation of 14th Street for really close on 25 years. So that's a long history of observing what's happening there. Do I think that an individual action is going to have changed behavior? I don't know that I want to change behavior. What I'm trying to say is that this kind of activity, this kind of intervention is what gives cities their bounce. The reason you find huge cities like New York have a certain resilience, or huge cities like Bombay have resilience, is because it's an extraordinary diversity and capacity to change. And so 2001's restriction of that kind of ability to act freely in space and try to find an aperture that opens it is part of that work. The more formal kinds of response I get is because the next time you go, the cops say, we know you. That is a kind of behavior change, right? So there will be that kind of work, which is the curatorial task of opening space, allowing something to happen. And that is a type of behavior change. But I don't expect the stray person, you walking down the street, to necessarily change. You might have an Instagram photograph. I mean, a lot of Art in Odd Places rests on, you know, exists on Flickr, unrelated to any work that any of the people involved in the show are doing. And it exists there because other people have taken photographs. And now in the era of Instagram and social media and so on, you can find, and that's another kind of impact. You're asking for a certain kind of what I personally think of as a scientistic approach to, and I'm trying to say that this is not about that kind of work. This is about a work that is interpretive, and it's about a work that is imaginative, and it is about entering cities with the spirit of play and poetry, not number crunching for all my interest in numbers. Yeah? So I will just tell you very, very quickly so that we can stop. So in 2012, at the SJDC, where I have a gallery, I have a strong interest in environmental issues, so we decided to create basically a 2.5 month exhibition, which was really an art shop. Art shop is like a workshop, but with artists, right? And there were a range of artists who are basically working in the intersections of art, teaching, pedagogy, and ecology, who came to the gallery over the course of 2.5 months. And the only way you could, in a sense, come to see anything in the gallery was to participate in a workshop. So when the show began, it was basically an empty gallery space with these, what we call bleachers. That is, bleachers are like the things you sit on when you go to football games or something. You know, they're the... So we created these, which were kind of large box-like, very brightly colored containers that also doubled up as sort of storage. So inside these, you had the ability to pull them out and create tables and chairs. You had a little refrigerator. You had art supplies. And there were a whole set of things. And that's all that existed in the gallery. And over the space from September through to December, artists came one after another and offered, either were in residence for a period or offered something. And if you were a member of the public or if you were a participant, you had to participate in that activity. So for For example, the PLOTS, Public Lab for Open Technology, did a DIY balloon mapping. That's basically aerial mapping using balloons. So they taught you how to construct a container for your camera, so a balloon could take it up into the sky, so you could map, you could do aerial mapping of an era. So we all went out, we mapped something, and this is basically us after we came back, and that's the balloon. The balloon remained in the gallery, as did sort of many photographs. Future Farmers came and did an ethnobotanical project looking at sort of native and invasive seeds in the area, and they were in residence, so this is them sort of working and bringing some of their input in. Tatfu is a urban farmer, and so he did a project basically on how to raise chickens in your backyards in New York City, so that's one of his. There actually two of them came, but that's two of them that are sitting there. Trade School is a project of Caroline Woolard, where basically the entire educational process is only on a barter basis. So I want to learn German from you, I have to give you something in return. So everybody got together over every evening. People would get together and sort of do a trade school project. Every artist group that was in the gallery doing something had to leave something, and so that's how the gallery started getting populated. Eco Art Tech do these sort of walks in the urban wilderness, and so they have a kind of an app, and you take the app and you do this very, in a sense, high tech wander through the urban kind of wilderness. Tuffy is a very important member of Eco Art Tech, and Tuffy also leads walks, which is why Tuffy is in the gallery too. But they have this sort of urban wilderness walk, so they actually have a tent, and you create this sort of strange kind of camping setup. Jill, basically over the entire course of from September onward, we collected plastic bottles and things that people were throwing. And this is the container. Jill is a dancer, so she's doing she's just playing around the container. And she created a hut. So at the end, she created an entire structure out of plastic bottles, which you could then go in, she would brew tea, and you could meet her and discuss issues of recycling. For those of you in my class, that's another way to come at the same approach. And I think that was it. So that's a very long, but hopefully not altogether tedious journey through projects I've done. I'd be happy to take other questions or more questions from you. Thank you.
Sie hörten
Radhika Subramania vom 21. Oktober 2014.
Produziert von Welle 20.